Arrivals at Tilbury. The Empire Windrush brings to Britain 500 Jamaicans, citizens of the British Empire coming to the mother country with good intent.
On June 22, 1948, the Empire Windrush docked at Tilbury. Among its passengers was a calypso singer from Trinidad.
Now, may I ask you your name?
Lord Kitchener.
Lord Kitchener. Now, I'm told that you are really the king of calypso singers. Is that right?
Yes, that's true.
Will you sing for us?
Right now.
Yes.
He'd composed this song on the voyage over from the Caribbean.
London is the place for me. London, this lovely city.
You can go to France or America, India, Asia or Australia, but you must come back to London City.
But black music in Europe doesn't begin with the Windrush. I'm Clark Peters. In this series, I'll be drawing on a vast archive of rare records to show how black music enthralled Europe from the Jazz Age to the 40s and beyond. From the Beguine, the sound of Martinique, transported to Paris in the 30s. To early highlife recorded in London in the 1920s. To hot jazz in Weimar, Berlin. Much of this music is being broadcast here for the very first time. This is a hidden musical history that stretches back much further than 1948. Today, we'll be listening to the sounds of black Europe from the late 20s through to the outbreak of the Second World War. Many of these rare sounds were tracked down by the German record collector and historian, Rainer Lotz.
Welcome to Bad Godesberg. Please come in.
The first time I heard jazz was when a friend of mine gave me a record, a Columbia record. I think it was number CL855. Duke Ellington plays Duke Ellington. For the first time in my life, I heard growl trumpet. I heard wordless scat vocals and things like that. That hit me like a brick. I was lucky in the sense that I grew up post-war. People wanted to buy new things and the old ones weren't cherished, so I was able to acquire quite a lot of those old Shellac records. There was little left after the war, and what went up in flames were gramophone records as well. And as everybody who owns a Shellac record knows, they burn like hell. They really go. If you put a match next to a Shellac record, it virtually explodes.
One of Rainer's prized possessions is a shellac pressing of this track. Recorded in Berlin in 1925, this is Shanghai Shuffle by the African-American bandleader Sam Wooding and his orchestra.
Berlin was a place. The Weimar Republic really was a time of entertainment, an explosion of the arts in cinema, in theater, in music. Until 1924, there was no jazz in Germany, really. Then in 1925, the first bands arrived, notably Sam Wooding. He accompanied the revue Chocolate Kitties. They were a sensation in Germany. They were really a sensation, and they were immediately called into the recording studios to make recordings.
Another star of Weimar Berlin was trumpeter Arthur Briggs.
Hello, everybody. This is Arthur Briggs and his band playing. Get ready to shake your hips to the bugle call rag. Are you ready, boys?
Yes! Yeah.
Arthur Briggs is the single most important black jazz musician that played Germany. he developed a tone of his own, immediately recognizable. Because of his long, long recording career, he influenced, I should say, all the musicians that had any interest in jazz during the time of the Weimar Republic and beyond.
Born on the Caribbean island of Grenada in 1899, Briggs was a huge success all across Europe in the 20s and 30s.
He was traveling around Europe. He appeared with his bands in Norway and in Belgium and in Turkey and in Hungary and in Italy and, you know, you name it, and he was there.
Here's Arthur Briggs speaking in an archive interview from 1982.
The Germans were very congenial. They're very cultured people. I had a really wonderful time in Germany. You have to try and find out what they want and give it to them. In general, the Germans loved the melody. Melody with a beat. The people, they were satisfied. We played good music.
In 1933, of course, there was a complete change. The National Socialists had no interest whatsoever in what they call jungle music. So the people in Germany who really wanted to hear jazz had to play it themselves all of a sudden. So the irony of history is that after the Nazi takeover, jazz flourished in Germany because people had to play it themselves. So the Nazis who were against jazz really promoted it because the people that had been occupied and were suppressed used jazz as a vehicle to express their love for freedom and independence. And so they didn't like German march music. They wanted swing, and they did it.
Before the Nazis began their crackdown on jazz, black musicians from the French Antilles were finding a new audience in Paris. This is the Beguine. A lively Creole music blending French, African, and Caribbean styles. It originated in Martinique in the 19th century. Played by musicians from the French Caribbean, the Beguine captivated Paris in the late 20s and early 30s. This music found a home at a small nightclub near Montparnasse. Julia Davis, an expert in the history of black Paris, takes up the story.
We are, at this moment, standing in the 15th district of Paris, the south end of Paris, and we're in front of a place, a mythical place, an iconic place, called La Belle Blume. Now, the interesting thing about La Belle Blume was a music called the Beguine. It has the rhythm of the Antilles, but it is a dance as well. It wasn't sophisticated. It was hot, and the club was a hot place to be. It was a place that mixed the black culture with the white culture, with the French culture, with the African-American culture, with the African, with the Caribbean culture, all mixed, and there was no other place like this in Paris. The ambiance at the Belle Blume in the 1930s was, I mean, Paris is a party town to begin with, but this place was different. It was literally hot. I mean, it was hot inside. Lots of people packed in together. So there were women from the West Indies, from Guadeloupe and Martinique and the islands, and they would be dressed very colorful skirts kind of tied around here, and they would have that scarf tied around their head here, and they would be dancing, moving their hips very seductively, but they danced with each other, they danced with men, they danced by themselves. It was a lot of freedom, you know, as Paris was in that time, very sexually free, so a lot of bare-breasted women, for example, dancing. So a Saturday night or a Sunday night at the Belle Blume, it was an immersion into a whole nother world.
Fabrice DeFalco is an acclaimed classical singer from Martinique, currently living in Paris.
I grew up in Martinique, and I discovered the Beguine thanks a trip with my teacher. And when I heard, it was like, oh, it's wonderful. It's like leader. It's like melody. When you heard the music, you want to dance. You want to forget who you are. You want to have a connection with other people.
The pioneers of the Beguine in Paris were musicians Alexander Stilio and Ernest Liardi.
When black people arrived in Paris, they wanted to have the same culture than Martinica or Guadeloupe. And Alexandre Stelio and Ernest Liardi, a violinist, a composer, they decided to go to Bal Blomé. The audience was in Bal Blomé, everybody. Politicians, musicians, artists, there are not problems with skins or with racism or everything. The Bal Blomé was like the place to be. All white people, all black people decided to be together to create a vibe in France. And a lot of people in Paris, maybe they never went to Martinica, but thanks to you, they was fascinated with the black culture.
But Paris wasn't the only place in Europe where diverse musicians came together between the wars.
Tiger Bay, Tiger Bay, it's not very far from the door.
Cardiff Bay was famous for its large multicultural community. Many of these people had roots in the Cape Verde Islands, a Portuguese colony off the coast of West Africa. These islands had their own distinct sounds, as captured on this archive recording from 1931.
It's really interesting always to look at dock communities because obviously you've got a coming and going from all over the world.
Professor Catherine Tagley is a historian focusing on early black music in Britain.
Cardiff is a great example of one of those ports referred to often as Tiger Bay or Bute Town, extremely multicultural. And there was a study that was done in the 1940s where they estimated, I think, around 50 different races and religions were living in that small confined area. At the time, the area that we refer to as Tiger Bay, it was, in many respects, it was considered a problem. The street that divided the bay from the town was quite notorious in terms of drinking and prostitution. There was that sense of even people that had never been to the bay had this particular view of it. Music was very strong, often really centering around plucked string instruments, guitars, mandolins, things of that sort, which would be easily brought from other places or taken aboard ship to provide entertainment.
One of the music-making centres in the Bay from the late 1920s onwards was the home of the Denise family. Born to a Cape Verdean father and Welsh mother, brothers Frank, Joe, and Laurie Denise all went on to successful careers in music. Here's their good friend, the singer Don Johnson, speaking in an archive interview from 1988.
Oh, well, we were always in the front room of Mrs. Dennis's house. And it was, if you'd gone in there, you wouldn't have believed it was like a music shop, because we were collecting all kinds of banjos, guitars, mandolins, ukuleles, and they were all stacked around the walls. But all we could play were calypsos, which we'd heard from records. We had quite a repertoire. There was one called Sly Mongoose.
Sly the Mongoose, now your name gone abroad. Sly the Mongoose, now your name gone abroad. Mongoose went into Bedford's kitchen, took up one of his father's chicken. That's the reason his life from Jamaica, Sly the Mongoose.
Another one called Black of the Woman, Sweet as She Be.
Blacker the woman, sweeter she be. Blacker the woman, sweeter she be. Just take it from Houdini, all black women sweet like a honeybee.
We've got a sort of a minor reputation as being a calypso group, and we got one or two offers to play in house dances. When the seamen came home from a good trip at sea, they'd be coming home with some money, you know. So they'd throw a house party, but they'd want some music. So they came to us.
People like the Denise brothers and their friends that were around Tiger Bay could kind of form little bands and play to entertain the local population. But I think as they grew up and the sort of reality of what their lives were going to be as adults, I mean, most likely they were also going to have to go to sea. This was not always a particularly appealing prospect. It was really hard work. Obviously, you're going to be away from home for long stretches of time. And so perhaps there was a little glimmer that music might offer a way out of that particular life.
Moving to London in the mid-1930s, the Denise brothers and Don Johnson turned to jazz. They would go on to record tracks like this, Soft Winds, featuring Frank and Joe Denise on guitar. While black musicians were forging careers in 30s London, such activities were unthinkable under the Nazi regime. Writer and radio producer Martin Esslin was working for the BBC's German service during the Second World War. Here he is speaking in an archive interview from 1987.
As the official Nazi view was that only Aryans can produce genuine creativity and therefore genuine culture, any art coming from non-Aryan races, and worst of all, blacks, was absolutely thought of being barbarian. And I still remember when I was about 9 or 10 years old, 1928, 29, in Vienna at the Opera House, there were tremendous riots because Ernst Krenek, you know, who was a great follower of and pupil of Schoenberg's, had written the first serious opera, Johnny spielt auf, Johnny Serenades, I think is the translation, in which the hero, in fact, was a Negro, a saxophonist. He introduced saxophone into the Vienna Opera House, and there were tremendous demonstrations, riots, that this holy temple of the German muses had been desecrated by Negermusik, Negro music.
Recorded in 1927, this is an extract from Ernst Krenek's Johnny spielt auf, which was enormously popular all across Europe in the late 1920s. Alongside composers such as Kurt Weill and Arnold Schoenberg, Krenek was demonized at the Nazi exhibition of Degenerate Music, held in Dusseldorf in 1938. The cover of the pamphlet that accompanied this exhibition displayed Johnny, the star of Krenek's opera.
In front of me, I've got a facsimile of the original pamphlet.
Peter Brathwaite is an opera singer who has been researching the Degenerate Music exhibition for many years.
The front cover of this is a caricature of an African-American musician. It's an ape playing the saxophone, wearing top hat and tails, and also wearing a Star of David and an earring. The musician is wearing a Star of David because, for the Nazis, jazz was a genre that was performed by black musicians, but then interpreted, arranged, promoted by Jewish people in the arts. As a black musician myself, I was taken aback by the exhibition brochure and the poster image of this caricature of an African-American musician. You really are able to see how dangerous it is when art is cleansed and certain artists are suppressed and when voices aren't heard. So if you walked in through the door to the Entartete Musik exhibition, the Degenerate Music exhibition, you would have been confronted with paintings, listening booths, and also slogans written on the walls. It was meant to be academic. The idea was that you would make your way through the exhibition, and once you'd finished, you would have been convinced that the action that had been taken, the mass aesthetic cleansing, was justified. What they didn't realise with the exhibition, that it sold out because the majority of people who were coming really wanted to listen to the music. So it was the one place that they could go and enter the listening booths and listen to music that they loved. Huge queues down the street, and they didn't have to do a lot to publicise it and make it sound appealing. I think the allure of something that is forbidden is enough.
While the Nazis were attacking so-called degenerate music, black entertainers like Arthur Briggs fled Berlin for Paris. But in June 1940, Paris fell to the German forces, as witnessed by this BBC reporter.
I stayed in Paris until late yesterday afternoon and was one of the last three British journalists to leave the capital.
I drove up the Champs-Élysées. Scarcely a soul was walking along the pavement. Down the middle, a few belated refugees drove their cars stacked with baggage and household belongings. A sad, deserted Paris, which I never want to see again like that.
Trumpeter Arthur Briggs stayed on in Paris. It was there that he was captured by the Nazis in October 1940.
I decided to stay, and I paid. When the Germans came in, I was at the club on the Champs-Élysées, and at 9 o'clock in the morning, came and picked us up.
He was interned by the German occupation authorities.
Record collector and historian Rainer Lotz.
And in that internment camp, he met various other African-American jazz musicians. So they must have been considered a sort of political prisoners by the Germans.
Everything was organized like a little city, you see, a country in a country. Tents and small barracks. What we didn't care so much about at first is when we gave them the cabbage soup with worms floating on it. If you had nothing else to eat, you would have to just cook the worms out and eat.
There, in that internment camp, he organized a big orchestra and gave concerts.
They had a group of about 30 amateur musicians. The only type of music we could play is light music and symphonies and things. That's the only music that was permitted by the Germans.
Okay, we are now moving into my little studio. Couple of three filing cabinets, metal cabinets, about chest high. And they're all full of photographs and programs and other artifacts. And we now search for other bricks. We move over here. Let me see. And here we are. Just on top is the program of the Camp des Internés Britanniques, La Grande Caserne de Saint-Denis, which is in the south of Paris, lundi 2 novembre 1942, concert symphonique, première partie, Arthur Briggs et son orchestre sous la direction de Tom Walton. And that is a program of classical music under the direction of Arthur Briggs on trumpet. And that concert was one of many that took place in the internment camp for other inmates and for Germans that were invited on the occasion, and that included von Stülpnagel, the commander of Paris at the time.
We gave a concert. It was more or less Beethoven's festival, the famous Fifth Symphony. And the commander of Paris, his name was General von Stülpnagel. He was the commander of Paris. And he came up, and they were very surprised. That party, they believed that everything was not of the Caucasian race, the monkey or anything else. At the end of the concert, the aide-de-camp shook my hands. And the general saluted. So I felt pretty good. I said, well, maybe I'd be spared, you know. And I guess that's one of the reasons why I'm here today.
Arthur Briggs spent nearly 4 years in the internment camp before being liberated by the Allied forces. He returned to Paris, where he worked as a musician until his death in 1991. Next week, we explore further sounds of Black Europe at the time of the Second World War. From Nazi jazz,
Shia propaganda, anti-British, anti-Jewish, anti-American later on.
Let's go bombing, oh, let's go bombing, just like good old British airmen do.
To Caribbean swing bands in the heart of London.
There was always a gig going on. London buzzed.